From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Daljit Dhaliwal, sitting in for Brooke Gladstone. For the past 2 weeks, a growing tally of burnt-out cars in France, like a war zone body count, has been repeated in the media like a mantra. The riots began in the Paris suburbs, but then spread throughout France and initiated copycat attacks in Germany and Belgium. The anger is blamed on the deaths of two Parisian youths who died while being chased by police. Susan Caskey has been looking at the coverage from around the world for The Week magazine. She joins me now. Susan, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, let's start with the coverage in France. How were French papers reacting to the violence at the beginning of the week, and how did the coverage actually evolve?
There was very little commentary initially. It was all news coverage. And then when the commentary started to come out, it focused on the political ramifications of the riots. Le Figaro, Libération, and Le Monde were talking about the rivalry between the Prime Minister, Dominique de Villepin, and the Interior Minister, Nicolas Sarkozy. So it really seemed like they were treating it as just another kind of theater on which this political rivalry could play out. One commentary in a German paper in the Frankfurter Rundschau took the French media to task. A commentary there said, "It is as if the intra-party quarrel over who should succeed Chirac were really more significant than the socio-political catastrophe, the material and moral misery that has found symbolic expression in flaming cars." And then we started seeing French commentary about international commentary. So still not so much French commentary about what was happening, but about how it was negatively affecting France's image.
So by the end of the week, was the French press tackling the problems?
Yes, they seem now to have really awakened to the fact that this is an enormous crisis, that it reaches deeply into French society. There was a commentary in the Charente Libre, which is a newspaper out of Cognac, where the commentator Jacques Guillon said, "We've been blind. We must open our eyes." And then he went on to say, "We have believed that repeating liberté, equality, fraternity often enough would integrate our immigrants, but that is not the case."
And what about other European countries? How did they cover it?
One thing that I found that was very interesting was that countries that have large immigrant populations but not Muslim immigrants are just as nervous about the prospect of rioting or of unrest as the countries with Muslim populations. And I think in the U.S. coverage, it tended to focus on, oh, these are Muslim immigrants and it's the big clash of civilizations. But in Europe, they're really not seeing it that way. There are editorials in Estonian newspapers talking about the Russian minority, which is a very large minority there. And they've had lots of trouble integrating the Russians into Estonia. And they're taking the French model as an example and saying, look what happens when you ignore your minority.
And in the Muslim world, how did it play out there?
Well, there's quite a diversity of opinion in the Muslim world, which is interesting. It was more diverse, really, than the European reactions. In Algeria, papers are concentrating mostly on criticizing the security measures that are now being taken, the state of emergency that's been called in France. Liberté, which is from the capital, and also Le Quotidien d'Orient, they are criticizing the resurrection of a French law from 1955. It allows enormous crackdowns. It allows police to fire on rioters if they need to. And this was last done when France was at war with Algeria. And so the Algerian papers are saying this is an outrage, and you're treating these French citizens who are no longer Algerian, you're treating them the way you treated us back in the colonial period, and it's going to backfire. But then over in other Muslim countries, in Iran, there are fewer Iranian immigrants in France. So Iran is really looking at this as an outsider. Iran had the harshest criticisms of France in the entire Muslim world that I saw. Lots of calls for boycott saying, "In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, France will be struck down for its response," things like that.
Okay, what about the United States, Susan? There we tended to see two dueling narratives that seemed to divide along party lines. From the right, the riots were seen as part of a clash of civilizations, and at one point it was even called the Ramadan Offensive. And then the left, the rioters were seen as a disenfranchised population fighting for liberty, fraternity, and equality. Is this what you observed as well?
In the U.S. press, definitely there was that split. And it's very different from the European press because Europe is not splitting in a left-right way that way. The Washington Post had an editorial saying, this isn't terrorism, this is venting. They're venting frustration at years of high unemployment and racism. And that was really the main thesis, that it's not about jihadis, it's not about an Islamist ideology. It has very little to do with Islam. It's about unemployment. And then you go over to some papers on the right, the Chicago Sun-Times ran a column by Mark Stein. He said, no, 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 this is the first skirmish in the Eurabian Civil War.
Thanks very much, Susan.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Susan Caskey rounds up the world's papers for the week.
What began as an emergency response to 9/11, the USA Patriot Act has over 4 years become institutionalized in law enforcement. One of its most powerful provisions relaxed the requirements for national security letters, a form of secret subpoena introduced in the 70s to track the transactions of suspected spies and terrorists. Until the Patriot Act, only about 300 of them were approved each year. But as Barton Gellman reported recently in the Washington Post, use of this investigative tool has grown exponentially, all outside of judicial, much less public, scrutiny.
In the last year for which they counted, and it's only a partial count, there were more than 30,000 of these letters issued. The Patriot Act in October of 2001 changed the standard. Now, if you're an FBI agent, you only have to affirm that the information may be relevant to an investigation to protect against terrorism, so that casual contact with someone who's a suspect may attract the interest of investigators and get you investigated yourself. Not the content of the conversation, but all the list of calls, all the list of emails, what you buy online, where you browse, what you search for on Google, whether you visited a pawn shop, how much you gamble. There's a quite intimate composite portrait that emerges from this.
Now, maybe one of the most terrifying things about this law enforcement tool is the secrecy behind it. If I am subpoenaed to reveal information about myself, or more likely about someone whose records I have, I am not permitted to tell anybody, any living soul, that I've been given this order. Is that right?
That's right. It begins with a fairly good reason. You don't want to tip off a terrorist or a spy that you are investigating him. What's unusual about these national security letters is that the secrecy is automatic, perpetual, and unappealable, so that it never expires. It was U.S. government policy until 2003, once an agent determined that the information was no longer relevant to the investigation, they were mandated to erase it. John Ashcroft reversed that order. His new guidelines, which are binding, say that the FBI shall retain all information gathered in investigations and shall share it fairly widely around the federal government and with some state and local governments.
Tell me about Las Vegas.
At the end of 2003, there was an orange alert. One of the reasons was a fragmentary report that there might be a terrorist attack in Las Vegas around the new year. They had no information on suspects, and so they tried for the first time ever to create an instant, real-time, moving census of every tourist and visitor in the city during its most visited period of the year. They sifted through about 1 million people who were considered potential suspects to see if they could find any match with any other indicator in their big database of the terrorist universe. So they used grand jury subpoenas, they used national security letters, and they got every hotel guest, every air passenger, every person who rented a car or a truck or a storage space, and they made a giant database out of that and started sifting it.
And what did they come up with?
In the parlance of the intelligence community, the whole thing washed out. They had no suspects. There was no attack. They had an undeniably important motivation here, but one of the prices that the country has paid for that is that on the order of 1 million people are now in government databases and are staying there. So if you got a Las Vegas hotel room, and maybe if you were there with someone you ought not have been there with, what happened in Vegas did not stay in Vegas.
I'm just curious, what is the list of successes that the FBI can point to because it's been able to issue these national security letters, you know, virtually at will?
Well, I asked a lot of FBI agents and senior officials to please come up with some examples. Not necessarily that a national security letter made a case disrupted the plot all by itself, but that it was a link in a chain that you could show that led to some good result. You made a connection you didn't have before. They were unable to come up with a case like that.
Any evidence that that you found that national security letters are being used to in any way monitor speech?
We know that the law says the FBI cannot gather information solely on the basis of protected First Amendment activities. The word solely is a pretty strong word. The FBI can use protected First Amendment activity, including speech or visiting scary websites, as a basis for monitoring someone. And the history of police and intelligence powers in this country and elsewhere, I think, suggests that when you give people a tool, they will use it. Tellingly, when one member of Congress asked the Justice Department, would it be sufficient basis that someone visits a website and is a member of a certain ethnic group, the Justice Department would not answer that.
How can it be that 4 years into the Patriot Act, the national security letters have not been challenged in court as, you know, as blatant intrusion of privacy?
Well, there have recently been two court cases. We know of only two cases ever in which they were challenged. The plaintiffs are not officially known to the public. I discovered one of them in the Connecticut library case that was the lead of my story. The librarian who received a national security letter was afraid to call a lawyer because the letter said that he shall not disclose to any person that he'd received it. But the reason there hasn't been much public debate until now is because no one had any idea what scale they were being used on. And crucially, people did not know, even in Congress, that the great majority of these letters ask for information about ordinary Americans and U.S. visitors who are not suspected of any wrongdoing.
Well, Barton, as always, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Barton Gellman is a reporter for The Washington Post.
Coming up, a Washington Post reporter faces censure over a classified leak. Also, where the latest stop on the Judith Miller Redemption Tour.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal.
And I'm Bob Garfield. With Washington still trying to pick up the pieces from one CIA leak investigation, another appears to be forming inside the Beltway. The Washington Post reported last week that the Central Intelligence Agency has, over the past 4 years, been operating secret terror suspect detention facilities in eight countries, including at least two Eastern European democracies, later revealed to be Poland and Romania. The immediate reaction from the Republican leaders in both houses of Congress was not to express outrage at a CIA prison archipelago, but to find out who leaked the story to reporter Dana Priest. They believe the story has threatened national security, but other critics are disappointed in the Post for pulling its punches. Peter Kornbluh is a senior analyst for the National Security Archive, a non-governmental organization that maintains a library of declassified information spanning more than a half century. He joins me now. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me on this important topic.
So based on what we have read in the Washington Post and now elsewhere, what do we know about the nature of these secret camps? In other words, how long have they existed? Why do they exist? And who's being held there?
They were created just after 9/11 when the CIA decided to start working as it needed to on rounding up al-Qaeda suspects. Some of them were taken to Guantanamo Bay. But the CIA quickly determined that it was going to have a lot of trouble doing what it wanted to do in secret there, and sought authorization from very high up in the U.S. government to create a whole network of internment camps, secret detention centers, where more than 100 terrorist suspects are being secretly held.
Now, on the scale of super double secrets, how big a revelation was this?
Well, I don't think anybody was surprised. What was important about the Washington Post story is that it was very specific to the network of these secret detention centers and the authorities under which the CIA developed them. And we have to pause here and say that the Post and Dana Priest deserve tremendous credit. She did excellent reporting, and we have to give credit to her courageous sources who are now going to become, you know, the targets of a Republican counterattack. But having said that, of course, in the end, her editors weren't quite as courageous, and they yielded to the request of senior administration officials to keep out, I think, an important part of the story, and that is the actual names of the Eastern European democracies where at least two of these major detention centers are being housed.
The Post went to the government and said, you know, we're running this story, and the government said, please, oh, please, oh, please, pretty please don't name the countries. And the Post complied, but you're not happy with that.
Well, I think that the Post should have published the names of these countries for three reasons. One is the right to know. The right to know in the United States of America what is being done in our name but without our knowledge. The second reason is that U.S. officials have routinely gone to editors like Len Downey and claimed national security, arguing that stories should be killed. This has been suspect in the past. Many of the stories have gone ahead and run, and national security has not been significantly damaged. The final reason it seems to me that this is a unique case is that by yielding to the argument that U.S. officials made to the Washington Post basically means that the Post is kind of loosely enabling these very activities to go on. And what these activities are the secret detention and abuse behind dark walls of prisoners, some of whom may be innocent. And I don't think it should be the kind of role of a U.S. newspaper in a free society like ours to be protecting the continuation of such atrocities by withholding this kind of information.
Point taken, but it's quite routine for major news organizations upon discovering something secret about the Pentagon or about the intelligence services to accede to requests, almost always on national security grounds, not to include certain points of information, maybe to protect operatives, maybe to protect sources and methods, or whatever the reason. Is this really very different from, you know, hundreds of other such negotiations made by news organizations, you know, after close consideration in the past?
No, I don't really think this was a negotiation. I think that Dana Priest, a very talented reporting, got this story, learned the identities of these countries, and then U.S. officials came in and basically over a period of a couple of weeks convinced Len Downey that they should not name the countries. There was one argument that they made that these countries could then become the target of kind of terrorist retaliation for collaborating with the CIA, and that seems to me to be the most salient argument of all. But I would point out that what is going on here is a response inside the CIA by CIA officials who don't agree that the CIA should now be jailers and torturers of these detainees, and who are talking to reporters like Dana Priest about their disagreement with the Bush administration's effort to go forward with this type of operation and policy.
Some months ago, the editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Doug Clifton, got a tremendous amount of criticism for acknowledging that his paper had at least temporarily spiked a couple of stories from whistleblowers, from anonymous sources, that he believed would have put his reporters in some jeopardy of criminal prosecution. Was Doug Clifton simply prescient in understanding that from this point forward, any story that embarrasses the administration, particularly about the war on terror, is going to unleash a political reaction that includes criminal investigation?
I hope he wasn't, because Dana Priest and her sources are true patriots, and they don't deserve the type of political harassment brewing right now. But I think there are people in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. Congress, hopefully some wiser people in the Justice Department, that understand that they will be seen as persecutors here, going that extra length to protect the ability of the Bush administration to continue to torture in secret. And that is the way it is going to be seen if the people who are telling the truth and trying to get a discussion going about this are faced with punishment of jail.
Well, Peter, once again, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Peter Kornbluh is a senior analyst for the National Security Archive. Leak investigations do indeed take their toll. Nobody knows that more than Judith Miller, the New York Times reporter jailed for contempt of court in the Valerie Plame leak investigation. She spent 85 days behind bars before getting the waiver she wanted from senior White House official Scooter Libby, whom she then identified as her hitherto anonymous source in the Plame affair. Adding insult to injury, Miller left jail only to be vilified for her pre-war stories about supposed Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, for her Bigfoot behavior at the Times, and for her professional conduct as a reporter. Much of the criticism stemmed from her own 3,000-word October article describing her conversations with Libby, who has since been indicted in the leak probe. The fallout culminated Wednesday with the announcement, following contentious negotiations, of her retirement from the New York Times. In a wide-ranging interview, which we excerpt here, Miller told us she did nothing improper in the leak affair. On the contrary, she maintains, she is a champion of journalistic principle.
Some people still felt that, you know, under no conditions should I have testified. But you know what? I never felt that way. I never felt that our right not to testify was absolute. I always felt that there were exceptions to the privilege that we were claiming. Every journalist, in the absence of a federal shield law, has to decide what constitutes a voluntary and explicit waiver. And my standards, I'm difficult. Everybody says that. My standards were just very high.
By your own retelling in the New York Times, you said that you agreed in conversations with Scooter Libby that you would identify him not as a high White House official, but in fact as a former Capitol Hill staffer, a technical truth. Now, it never showed up in the newspaper, but you made an agreement with him to identify him that way.
No, I did not.
Am I correct?
No, you are wrong. I never agreed to identify Scooter Libby in print by that attribution. I agreed to listen to what he had to say under that attribution. If I had ever used that information, I would have gone back to him, as I have done with other sources, and said, you know, this attribution simply won't fly. Let's talk about an attribution which reflects who you really are but doesn't identify you.
You said to him, yes, I will listen to your story as a former Capitol Hill staffer, and then you let him tell you what he had to tell you, correct?
Absolutely.
And then had you decided to print, then you would go back and try to get him to change the
terms.
Not
try to
get
him. He would either change the attribution or I wouldn't use the information. Or I would go to somebody else for the information and get it confirmed, hopefully on the record, which is what happens all the time in Washington national security reporting.
Well, then forgive, please, the do you still beat your wife question, but if you had no intention of using that attribution that you negotiated, then why have the negotiation to begin with?
Because I was interested in listening to what the man had to say.
So one promise you make to your source is so important that you'll go to jail to honor it, but another is just a trick to get information.
No, it's not
Doesn't
a trick.
It's called
reporting.
Doesn't that take the air out of your claim to be acting on principle?
Excuse me. You want to argue with me, fine. But that's the way that I conducted this interview and the way things unfolded. There was no story, so we'll never know whether you're right or I'm right. But there is one difference. Mr. Libby has never been identified in any way, shape, or form as anything other than an administration official in one of my stories, and moreover, in 28 years of journalism, I have never ever been accused by my paper of misattributing a source, not once.
Let's move away from the particulars of the Plame affair for a moment and sort of the other general allegations that have been made against you by outsiders and insiders at the Times. You've acknowledged that your WMD reporting in several material instances, got it wrong. But you've also said that the story is only as good as its sources.
Right.
To put the question in plain language, Judy, were you played for a chump by these sources, Ahmed Chalabi in particular?
You know, first of all, I'm not going to be insulted by your question, but I think that the sources that I relied on were reliable. They had been reliable in the past. I'm not going to discuss who they were, though many of them were actually identified by name in my stories. Moreover, those stories were heavily edited. They just didn't dance their way into the New York Times. As the editor's note acknowledged, everybody's wrong if your sources are wrong.
There is this kind of archetype in journalism of the State Department reporter who takes to smoking pipes and wearing tweed, and the police reporter who puts lights in his car, and other reporters who become so associated with the beat that they're on that they cease to be distinguishable from the people they're actually covering. Were you so immersed in spooks that you sort of started seeing yourself as a spook yourself?
Oh, hardly. You know, I'm a journalist. Those lines don't get blurred. But yeah, I do hang out with sources. If I was hanging out with fellow journalists, I usually wasn't learning anything. If I was hanging out with, national security policy wonks, I tended to learn something.
Is there nothing to the charge that you are so successful in getting to the corridors of power that you're at times unable to distinguish what is good information from manipulation?
You know, look at my record and look at the record of stories, and you'll see that the about 90% of them are not only accurate, but were front page stories that have been widely praised. And I think that, the record will answer that question.
But your record also includes a half dozen or so stories about weapons of mass destruction.
A half dozen. How many stories do you think I've written over my 28-year career at the New York Times? We're talking about half a dozen stories out of a career of literally hundreds and hundreds of stories, many of which have won prizes. And, yeah, at times every reporter is going to get things wrong. I've already said I got WMD wrong. I've never said I'm a perfect reporter.
But under the circumstances, considering how critical the New York Times reporting on this subject was to the administration's case for war, have you looked inwardly amid all of this controversy and said, not only did I make mistakes, but I made egregious mistakes, and this is really hard to live with? Just how comfortable are you with your reporting?
Excuse me. Every time I make a mistake in a story, I go back and I look and I say to myself, how did I get this wrong? I honestly believe that if you look at my stories, and very few people have even bothered to read them, you will see that the information that I was given was always vetted by outside independent experts. Did this make sense? Was it possible? Was it probable? I wish that people were more concerned about how the U.S. intelligence community, all of the agencies, got it so wrong.
Well, I'm glad you posed that question, because it's true, they got that wrong. They got the Iranian Revolution wrong. They got the fall of the Berlin Wall wrong, and understanding Soviet economy and military capability wrong. The U.S. Intelligence apparatus has gotten a great number of things wrong going back decades.
Absolutely.
Which makes me wonder what greater degree of skepticism a reporter should apply to anything coming from these very sources.
I do think that there was a difference here. Like on the famous aluminum tube story that Michael Gordon and I wrote in the fall of 2002 leading up to the war, you know, the reason we thought that the administration knew what it was talking about was that these tubes weren't kind of theoretical tubes or reports of tubes. These were tubes the CIA had. They had them in their possession. They were analyzing them. They were looking at them. They were touching them, feeling them, smelling them. And if they said these are tubes for a nuclear weapons program, my gosh, I thought, you know, this is a real thing. We did the best we could with the information we had available. And I was glad to see that another group of reporters went on and looked at that issue in greater depth. But it shows you how really broke the intelligence community system is. And am I skeptical? Yeah, you're right. Now I don't think I'm ever going to believe anything I'm told from the intelligence community if it's not checked 15, 20 different ways. And even then, there's still a possibility we'll get it wrong.
All right, Judy. Well, thank you very much for doing this.
Okay, thank you.
Judy Miller is a former reporter for the New York Times.
Scooter Libby, Karl Rove, Valerie Plame. It's all so confusing for those of us who want an accurate picture of what goes on in the White House. So thank goodness for White House press briefings, such as the one conducted on October the 31st by Presidential Press Secretary Scott McClellan, to clarify where things stand. Here's McClellan in an exchange with NBC's David Gregory.
We know that Karl Rove, based on what he and his lawyer have said, did have a conversation about somebody who Patrick Fitzgerald said was a covert officer of the Central Intelligence Agency. We know that Scooter Libby also had conversations.
That's accurate.
So aside from the question of legality here, you were wrong.
Perhaps you thought you heard McClellan say that's accurate. Well, according to the White House transcript of the briefing, you're mistaken. The official White House version has McClellan saying, "I don't think that's accurate." Listen again.
Libby also had conversations.
That's accurate.
So aside from the question...
The words, "I don't think," are a little hard to make out, possibly because, as the videotape of the briefing makes clear, McClellan never uttered them. Yet the White House not only placed them in its official transcript, it approached two outside services who transcribe briefings for the media and asked them to change their versions, and offer those services declined. Maybe McClellan simply misspoke and wished to correct an honest mistake, but transcripts typically record what was said and not what was meant to be said, as the White House apparently understands. Speaking to editor and publisher magazine Administration Presse, Dana Perino insisted she heard the conversation just exactly as it appears on the official transcript. That's their story, and they're sticking to it, whether it's accurate or not.
Coming up, putting the local back in local news, and swing shoppers beware, Walmart wants your vote.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Daljit Dhaliwal. Being the world's largest retailer and North America's largest private employer has advantages and disadvantages. At Walmart, everyday low prices have also translated into everyday bad publicity. For years, it has been accused of destroying Main Street, exploiting employees, and raping the labor markets of the developing world. With the premiere this week of an anti-Walmart documentary film, the company's PR challenges are going to the next level, and so too is the PR response, a war room staffed with political operatives and public relations specialists to get out good news and confront the bad. Apart from the short-term urgency, says Stephen Greenhouse, workplace and labor reporter for the New York Times, the goal is to win the hearts and minds of middle-class consumers the company is increasingly anxious to win over. And he joins us now. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of these people who are in the political war room. Who are the heavy hitters behind Walmart's makeover?
There are some very heavy hitters, including one of the heaviest of all, Michael Deaver, who was one of Ronald Reagan's key image advisors. And then there's Leslie Datch, who was a media advisor to Bill Clinton, and Jonathan Adashek, who was head of national delegate strategy for the Kerry campaign. They've hired the Edelman public relations firm, one of the most respected public relations firms in the country, and they have many other operatives from Republican campaigns and Democratic campaigns. I think in ways what Walmart's doing is it's often viewed as a red state company and is hiring some blue staters to help them, especially with the opposition they face in blue states and, you know, some of the bluest of cities like L.A., Chicago, and New York. And they're hoping that some of these Democratic operatives will have ties to Democrats and labor unions.
So why is Walmart going down this route?
For many years, Walmart was growing slowly, and the cultural elite, the news media, did not pay much attention to them. And now Walmart's getting criticized by a movie, by several groups supported by unions that are seeking to pound Walmart very hard to pressure Walmart to improve its wages and benefits. The largest class action employment lawsuit in American history is pending against Walmart. And the lawsuit alleges that Walmart discriminated against women in promotions and pay. More than 1.5 million women. And Walmart's very, very worried that the lawsuit could alienate a lot of its customer base and discourage some consumers from shopping at Walmart.
And you wrote about an internal Walmart memo leaked to the New York Times a few weeks ago detailing the company's plans to aggressively keep down employee health benefits while minimizing damage to the company's reputation. Now, that was a particularly high-profile embarrassment. Given this, do you see their PR effort then as a charm offensive, or are they really talking about making more substantive changes to their business practices?
I would think it's mainly a charm offensive. And this memo makes very clear that they're extremely image conscious. And I think if you read the memo closely, it appears that they're trying to improve their image on the cheap. They say they're increasing their benefits, but they plan to pare their benefit spending by about $1 billion over the next few years, or they hope to at least.
And they're also offering things like journalism scholarships. What's that about?
I think that's very smart of them. About a year ago, they decided we're going to go out into the public forum and we're going to improve our image and we're going to give money to many African-American groups, to Hispanic groups, and miracle of miracles, they're also sponsoring these journalism fellowships.
There was a recent article in the New York Times which said that Walmart had taken a page, essentially, out of the political playbook and that it was chasing the swing voter.
Walmart realizes that it has many very loyal consumers. You know, 80-85% of the American people shop at Walmart each year. It also realizes that there are naysayers, liberals, you know, folks who live in New York City or Vermont who just aren't going to shop at Walmart. But Walmart also realizes that there's a group of swing shoppers or swing voters who could perhaps be swayed to stop shopping at Walmart if they see these negative movies, read these negative articles. Walmart hired McKinsey & Company, the consulting firm, and McKinsey found that somewhere between 2 and 8% of shoppers have decided to stop shopping at the company because they've been affected by negative information about Walmart.
Well, one place where the company did get a lot of brownie points was the way in which they swung into action with their Katrina relief efforts. It's no secret that Walmart has legions of critics, but are they getting credit where credit is due?
I think Walmart did a marvelous job on Katrina. CEO Lee Scott is brilliant at distribution and logistics. Someone wrote an article saying that Lee Scott should have been hired as head of FEMA. Walmart certainly did a better job than FEMA in getting important materials out to its stores when FEMA lagged behind. And Walmart really then tried to milk that to get some good publicity.
And you've also written that Walmart has these designs on the middle class, urban tastemakers, so to speak. I mean, that is a consumer base that's different from the one that they've built their business around, essentially. How has this changed their message then and their ads and also their image?
Now, Walmart traditionally focused on the low-income shopper, especially in the South. And it's seeing that income wages for the bottom half of American society is not growing very rapidly. The top half has been doing better in terms of earnings. And Walmart sees Target and Neiman Marcus and Saks doing better than Walmart in terms of comparable store sales, and it says, hey, we want some of that. We want more of that. So it's moving upscale, and it's going after a more sophisticated market, people who read papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times and Business Week and see negative stories about Walmart.
Stephen, thanks very much for joining us on the program.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Stephen Greenhouse is a labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times.
The Virginia gubernatorial vote on Tuesday was hailed as a bellwether for next year's crucial congressional elections. So you'd think that the local TV news would be all over the story. Think again. According to an analysis by the Center for Media and Public Affairs, the four major stations serving Virginia's biggest population center in their 5 o'clock news hour collectively broadcast a grand total of 11 stories on the governor's race in the 4 weeks before Election Day. And the dearth of local campaign coverage is hardly specific to the Old Dominion. Armed with research documenting similar local non-coverage, the Media Access Project Public Interest Group is filing petitions with the FCC to block the license renewal of all the major commercial TV stations in Chicago and Milwaukee. The group says that by offering so little in the way of local politics last November, those stations, quote, failed to meet the needs of their community of license. The petitions were based on research carried out by the Center for Media and Public Affairs, and that group's president, Dr. Robert Lichter, joins us once again. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So your group looked at the election coverage on five affiliates in both Milwaukee and in Chicago. Tell me what you found.
Well, the Chicago study isn't out yet, but in Milwaukee, we looked at almost 500 hours of news programming in the month coming up to the 2004 elections. And we found that only about 5% of the coverage dealt with the elections overall, including the presidential election. And of the election coverage, only 4% dealt with local races, ballot initiatives. So it comes down to five stations in a month in their morning and afternoon and evening newscasts ran a grand total of 46 stories on all local election races.
That's pretty remarkable. And I'm just going to gather that of those 46 stories, not a whole lot of them were devoted, say, to the underlying policy issues in the election.
Well, as a matter of fact, because we're kind of insane in what we do, I can tell you that exactly 22% of those dealt with the underlying policy issues.
Now, on the face of it, these data are simply horrifying. But there has been some reaction from these local markets to the Media Access Project's license challenge. And they say that, first of all, there is other coverage that the local stations do that doesn't happen during the evening news, that they have debate coverage and so forth. And they also say that, particularly in Wisconsin, which was a major swing state in the 2004 election, a national story is also a local story, that the presidential election affected all communities in their broadcast area.
Well, of course, the presidential election is extremely important, but it is covered very heavily on the national network news. So one would think that the local news would see its franchise as the elections that are not covered on the national news, and that's clearly not so. About three-quarters of all the local news election coverage was on the presidential race. As regards public affairs programming, only two stations had any public affairs programming apart from the regular newscasts, and one of those broadcast a documentary that was on a controversy over Sinclair Broadcasting's attempts to air a documentary on John Kerry's service in Vietnam that raised great controversy for being so critical. And that accounted for an hour out of 2.5 hours of public affairs programming.
A couple of years ago, another public interest group called the Alliance for Better Campaigns produced similar data, which documented not only the near absence of coverage of local elections, but they suggested that the reason is that the stations are getting a windfall during the same periods of paid advertising, and that to the extent that they don't run news stories, the advertising becomes all the more valuable because it's the only way the public learns about the races. Have you tried to figure out what the whys are behind this stunning radio silence during election periods?
Well, I'm not sure I'd agree with that it's quite that Machiavellian. I mean, my guess is that it's simply a matter of what they think is going to attract audiences. We did a study of dozens of stations around the country a couple of years ago for the Kaiser Family Foundation and found that on the average, in the 30 minutes that was highest rated, after you take away the promos, the commercials, the sports, the weather, and the crime news, you had 6 minutes left for all other news. Crime really sells. If it bleeds, it leads. You know, started in local news. And election news, I think, especially local election news, they've decided just doesn't sell well enough. That's my guess, that it's very straightforward.
Is there really any chance that the FCC is going to decide not to renew these licenses? I mean, is this much more than a publicity stunt by the Media Access Project?
I certainly wouldn't call it a publicity stunt, and I don't know what the FCC will actually do. These findings are grounds to tell the stations, this is wrong. Tell the government this is wrong. Tell the regulators it's wrong. These people are curators of a scarce resource, part of the broadcast spectrum, that they hold partly to serve the public interest. And if this is the way they use it, I think the public should make its voice heard.
Well, Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Dr. Robert Lichter is a professor of communications at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and president of the Center for Media and Public Affairs in Washington, D.C.
The requirement that broadcasters serve the public interest is almost as old as television itself. The provision was laid out in the Communications Act of 1934, and ever since then, people have been squabbling over exactly what that means. As we've just heard, a popular interpretation has been that local interest equals public interest, thus the emphasis on local election coverage. And in general, the FCC has tended to agree with that interpretation. But earlier this year, the Harvard Law Review published a 100-page article arguing that the FCC has placed too much emphasis on local at the expense of public interest. UCLA law professor Jerry Kung wrote the article, and he joins me now to explain what he meant. Jerry, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure.
So it would seem to me that the more time a local station spends reporting on news in its own community, the more that community's interest is being served. Do you disagree?
Well, it may or may not be the case. If you look at local news today, it turns out that crime stories, especially violent crime stories, occupy approximately 25% of all local news stories. And the constant inundation of violent crime stories, I think, has large negative consequences that we have not considered seriously in thinking about the public interest.
But why isn't this a reflection of what's actually going on in these cities?
I think that's a fair question. One might say journalists have an obligation to report the cold, hard facts on the ground, even if it might be displeasing or politically incorrect. The problem with that is that even if crime rates are decreasing, crime story coverage is not necessarily decreasing. There's no proportionality in the actual depiction of these stories. Also, there's, I think, pretty good evidence that we have actually disparate representation of crime stories that disfavor minorities and poor people.
And what is the effect of so much local news crime coverage?
I think there is excellent social science evidence that it leads to a particular sense of fear and loathing and anxiety among the consuming public. So if you watch a lot of local news, you think the world is far more dangerous than it in fact is. Political scientists have measured the fact that if you introduce local crime stories to people in an experiment, they are more likely to vote for punitive crime measures like three strikes and you're out on political surveys conducted right afterwards. And social cognition research suggests that exposure to particular sets of images and meanings that associate black and brown faces with violent crime likely increases what scientists are calling implicit bias against these social categories. And we tend to think of stories that are negative about other people, other races, in more essentialist terms, thinking that it is by their very nature that they are violent or criminal. Whereas if it's a story about, quote, ourselves, we tend to think it as an individual aberration.
Well, let's take the example of the French riots this week. Now, if these riots were taking place, for instance, let's say in Los Angeles, would you favor devoting only a few minutes to covering them on the evening news?
No, I think things that are newsworthy, such as what's going on in Paris or the L.A. riots back in 92, are newsworthy. And under our robust First Amendment, I don't think it makes any sense ultimately to try to actually limit that. Nonetheless, we have in the past capped the number of commercials that we air per hour. We cap indecency in many ways. We penalize bad speech, including profanity. We affirmatively require broadcasters to show good speech in the form of children's television. So the question is not whether we regulate. The question is how much and for what reasons we regulate.
If your proposals were taken up, do you think that the quality of programming would improve substantially? I mean, let's be realistic here. Would we start seeing a lot more coverage of local politics, for instance? Or would we just see a lot more reporting on vicious weather and water skiing squirrels?
I think the FCC could generate practices among stations that would actually lead to better news. What people have to recognize is that the images that we convey, whether they be in fiction or nonfiction, have consequences, just like we do in the context of indecency. And before we unthinkingly lionize and fetishize the absolute number of hours of local news as being most important, we ought to consider other aspects of the public interest. We have to recognize that quality ought to beat quantity.
All right, Jerry, thanks very much.
Fantastic. Great interview.
Jerry Kung is a professor at the UCLA School of Law.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited this week pretty much by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Katie Holt and Kevin Schlottman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will return next week. I'm Daljit Dhaliwal.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
This is Ira Flatto, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI, to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.